This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, a conversation with film scholar David Thompson. His latest book is The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. He sizes up in this book Hollywood's thrills and disappointments, what he calls the art and the awfulness of the movies. The title from the book comes from the unfinished F. Scott Fitzgerald novel, The Last Tycoon, and Thompson includes this from the novel as an epigraph to his history of Hollywood. You can take Hollywood for granted like I did, or you can dismiss it with the contempt we reserve for what we don't understand. It can be understood, too, but only dimly and in flashes. Not half a dozen men have ever been able to keep the whole equation of pictures in their heads. Not half a dozen men have ever been able to keep the whole equation of pictures in their heads. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions, comments, your observations about the movies. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WYLL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. David Thompson taught film studies at Dartmouth College. He served on the selection committee for the New York Film Festival, a regular contributor to many publications. He is the author of 19 books, including In Nevada, The Land, The People, God, and Chance, and Rosebud, The Story of Orson Welles. He's updated his biographical dictionary of film, now titled The New Biographical Dictionary of Film. It is available in hardcover and paperback from Knopf. His new book, The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood, also published by Knopf. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. David Thompson, welcome. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've been on your show before, and I've always enjoyed it.
Oh, well, good. Thank you. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Hollywood can be understood only dimly and in flashes, says Cecilia Brady in The Last Tycoon.
Yeah.
A couple of questions here. What's the context for her words, and why do you think it is important to try to get hold of the whole equation?
Well, she is a character in the book. She is the daughter, a college-aged daughter, of a man who is a studio boss. And, you know, she's been raised in the business. She takes it very much for granted because she's known it from childhood up. But she's going to a good school. She's going to Bennington. And she's a smart young woman, and she's obviously realized, and I think this is something that we all have to realize, is that the movies, which began as a strange mixture of business and entertainment and art, maybe, have had a huge effect, not just on Americans, but on the way in which the rest of the world regards America. And, you know, I think that as someone who was born into the business, she's beginning to realize as she becomes an adult that it's a very, very tricky thing. And I don't know whether you were noting it and commenting on it. I felt perhaps you were in your tone of voice, that she says, and this is a woman saying it, that only half a dozen men have ever understood the whole equation. You know, because it's a very intriguing question, I think, whether in the history of Hollywood a woman has ever risen to a position of such power where she maybe has understood the whole thing.
In the book, at some point, I believe these are your words, or something to the effect, you say something to the effect of, we really, because of the significance, because of the impact of Hollywood and the movies, we really have a duty to look at where this industry has come from, not only as a business, but also as an art form. And here, maybe if you would you like to talk a bit about your feelings about the importance of history and memory?
Well, I don't know where to begin. I'm not sure that beyond words and language, I know anything more important than history and memory. Let me just launch off on one particular angle, because I think it's easier to give a concrete example. I was born and raised in Britain, and I think that for someone of my age, the experience has been very much like the experience of a person in America of the same age. And if I say to myself, what Arabs did I see growing up? Almost all the Arabs I ever encountered would be Arabs in adventure movies, where, generally speaking, the Arabs were played as scoundrels, villains, rogues, unreliable, untrustworthy. If you look at it in detail, they were almost invariably played by actors who were not Arabs, and who therefore had no more knowledge of Arab culture than I had. They were played by old people like Anthony Quinn, even in Lawrence of Arabia, if you remember, which is a pretty respectable film. He plays an Arab chief. Alec Guinness plays an Arab king. There's a very good example of how far we have all grown up with an impression from the movies that lands you in a whole lot of trouble when your country suddenly decides to get involved with, quote, Arabs, and really hasn't got the first idea of the language they speak, of what they believe, of what their history is, what their collective memory is, what they might feel, how they might be offended, and how we might relate to them. Now, you know, that's obviously a provocative example from modern times, but I think it's a good example of the way our folklore has been based on flim-flam and really not any adequate sense of history and memory that is just skewed by melodrama and storytelling.
Yeah, you start to think about it, it's truly amazing.
You could say exactly the same thing for Native Americans.
Exactly.
For a long time, you could have said the same thing about black people. I think you could say the same thing about women in a certain way. I mean, there was a long period in Hollywood where women were seen in very stereotyped terms. Maybe they still are, I'm not sure, you know. And we live with these problems because the impact and the influence, the cultural influence of storytelling, and the movies are a part of it, but I think they're the most potent part of it, movies and television, it's enormous. And education doesn't do a great deal to get over it.
In the book, you write about reading. I mean, we have The Last Tycoon. There are other books that you mention in the whole equation, your history. And you talk a couple of different points. You talk about reading and the difference between reading and going to the movies. At one point, you say reading offered us a chance to succeed, movies the alternative of dreaming. And that's a pretty interesting thing to think about. Maybe you would talk with us about the movies, dreaming, fantasy, and desire, and the difference between that and reading.
Well, I'll try. It's a huge subject, so give me a few minutes. And I think that reading gives you a book, gives you words on the page, and assuming that you have learned to read, you are then in a situation where you can deal with the material. If you come to a sentence that baffles you or perplexes you, you can read it again and again. You can put the book down and you can think for a bit and you can go back to the book. A book is something where you are in charge and you are responsible you may give the book up. You may decide this is not for me. But that's your decision. And you as a being, as an intelligence, are called into action by the book, and the process of reading is one of developing understanding and critical awareness and questioning of what you're reading and of what words mean, of what characters are beginning to emerge as in a book. Now, movies, by contrast, and I think it's very important to get this contrast, movies have an automatic life of their own. You can't stop the movie and say, oh, play that scene again. I'd like to just check what he said. You can do it on the VCR, mm-hmm. but you couldn't do it at the movies in the old days. You could get up and walk out, but you know the movie plays on. The movie has a force that ignores you. You are not called into being. You are not asked to be responsible in the same way. But you are given a rare, privileged, voyeuristic position. Because you're told, you stay in the dark. We won't notice you. And you can watch, you can spy on intimate things. You can spy on people being happy and unhappy, going through great stress and ordeal, taking their clothes off maybe. There's always a sexual element there in the movies. You can spy on it. And if someone's being hurt in the film, you don't have to cry out, stop. You don't have to intervene in the way you might do in life because you have no responsibility. You have no place. Now, if that goes on long enough, and the movies have been going on 100 years and more now, I think what is encouraged is a notion that we are not participants in our world, but we are simply observers who do not have responsibility, and we do not have the power to intervene. We're less valuable, I think, than the readers of books are made to feel. Now, that's putting it very tightly, but I hope you understand what I'm on.
I'm so glad you're on the program, and I'm really happy to have been able to spend a couple of hours reading the whole equation. I haven't completely finished it, but what I like about it is history, criticism, and personal essay together. And that's the kind of conversation I think we're having here this afternoon, and I'm just delighted that you're on the program.
Me too.
Film scholar David Thompson, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. You know, back to that idea of trying to grab hold of the whole equation, to understand this medium. How did you make this decision to include history, criticism, and personal essay? Is that where you started from with this book?
Well, I've been writing about film now for quite a long time. I mean, I suppose over 30 years, and I've done several books that are on film, and I have found that for myself, and I think I found that it begins to work with readers, I'm not so keen on simple film criticism. Is this a good film or is that a bad film? I'm interested in questions like, what do the movies do to us? How do the movies make us think? And what has happened historically to a country that in many ways, like this country, has grown up with the movies? And I have found, and I think the experience of teaching was very important in the way I write, because when you teach, you may lecture for 10 minutes. You know, you may need to sort of give a factual introduction to a topic, and you may need to sketch in that background, and for 10 or 15 minutes, let's say, you want the students to be quiet and listen to what you're saying and take notes, because you're passing on a lot of information that's valuable and necessary for what follows, which is a conversation. And in my experience, education always worked best when it was conversation. I don't think people can listen to a lecture for that long. I think they want to participate. I mean, it's like a show like this. You've got listeners, and you're going to have them calling in soon, aren't you? It's that feeling that everyone wants to offer their view and get into an argument, maybe. And nothing wrong with argument. You know? Disagreement is educationally, I think, much more fruitful than agreement. If you've got students who simply say, oh, yes, 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 professor, I agree, you're not going to get too far. Where you're going to really make inroads is if a student says, something you just said shocked me and disturbs me, and it's shaken me up, and can you explain it again? Because I don't think I agree, but I'm troubled. I want to get into it. That kind of conversation, I think, is about as useful as education can be. And I think I try to write in a way that will prompt the reader into thinking hard and thinking anew and almost sort of answering the book back.
Mm. Let's talk with a couple of listeners. We're going to go first to Champaign County, a caller on line one. Hi.
Hi. Interesting colloquy. I hope. I don't want to take anything away from this idea that you presented about sort of the way movies maybe participate in sort of creating or misapprehending culture and history. But it made me think of another one, which is we have all these epics where the pyramids are built by the slaves, and it turns out the latest archaeology says that the pyramids weren't built by slaves. They were built by sort of small freeholding communities that lived in the area.
Yeah.
So, but on a specific sort of dimension of the history of Hollywood, I'm looking at I guess it's a book list from Andrew Dawson's reading list for a seminar in Greenwich University in England, and he focuses on, in fact, I'll just quote him, it's often argued that movie studio first intervention in politics was during the 1934 election for the governor of California, and that by making, I think, movie reels and newsreels and things, they defeated Upton Sinclair. I'm wondering whether you treat that sort of historical, I mean, a real bit of, something that comes right out of... We have this apprehension that Hollywood is sort of the liberal element, despite the fact that Reagan and Schwarzenegger comes out of it. But this is a very early. Some of the books are Hearst over Hollywood and Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor and the Birth of Media Politics, and it talks about this dimension. I don't know if you even have that in as a footnote, but it's...
I talk about it in the book, and Hollywood has meant very different things politically. It's true that I think today maybe a majority of the people who work in Hollywood would vote Democratic and would be liberal, but the industry, the business, has always been essentially very right-wing. It wants to protect the status quo. It wants to protect business. And it has always been extremely frightened that its own position might be threatened, might even be threatened by federal intervention, federal controls. I mean, you know, the industry takes great care to be its own censorship-controlling body so that it can avoid any kind of federal censorship. And, of course, there is a big, horrible example of really craven, cowardly response on the part of the industry when the House Un-American Activities Committee began to investigate Hollywood after the end of the Second World War, I think on absolutely spurious claims. And the industry, the studios, the people who ran the business, banded together, supported the House Un-American Activities intervention, and began blackballing people, which was illegal, first of all, and extremely unrewarding to people who had worked hard and long for the studio system. And I think it's a moment when Hollywood loses its own confidence and loses that last vestige of it being a family. There was a notion in the 20s and the 30s that filmmaking was a sort of community. I think it really breaks up in those years after the war when red baiting takes over and when blacklists are formed and lives are literally destroyed because of it. So, no, I think that the political interaction of Hollywood and the rest of America is absolutely fascinating. And we've had a number of presidents who've been movie fans, to put it mildly. But essentially, I think the great influence of Hollywood has been to cultivate and encourage right-wing heroic figures like Ronald Reagan, obviously. I mean, who would have believed once upon a time that an actor, and a not very good actor at that, could become president? I can remember that when that was nearly unthinkable.
Well, thank you. You provoked me just with this bit of, I guess it's miscellany that just came out that Nixon actually saw like something like 500 films in one.
There's a very good book on Nixon at the movies out at the moment by Mark Feeney. I think that may be the book you're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent book. Yeah. Yeah, he was a big movie goer, and sort of most nights in the White House he would run a movie.
Do you spend a chapter? I mean, the red baiting and the blacklisting has been covered somewhat. There's a new book also by a woman who was in exile for 30 years. I forget her name, too, but telling
I certainly talk about the red baiting and blacklist period, and I try to stress just how much there is still, I think, an enormous need for an apology from the film industry.
Instead, they gave a lifetime achievement to Kazan, right?
Yeah, which was a very provocative gesture.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. Listener in southeastern Illinois on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hello.
Suddenly the volume level dropped. Usually it gets louder. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Okay. I could get into that the communists and all that sort of thing, but I think it would take more time than I would be allotted, and I'd rather talk about some other things that I think are interesting about the movies as an experience. You've already mentioned VCRs, and of course most movies today are seen by most people. DVDs and videos than they are in the movies. The movie in the theater is basically the important thing is to establish a reputation. It's like a play on Broadway. It establishes a reputation on Broadway, and then it plays all over the country and feeds off of that reputation on Broadway. So I think that currently movies, of course, I know the experience is different, although in multiplex, small screen, I don't know whether there's that much difference in all the big screen TVs, but it's interesting. The movies, you were talking about reading, and the difference, of course, between the movies as they used to be was that the movies were a social experience. You were with a group of people, other people, in reading and watching a movie at the movie theater, and in a book, you are alone with the author of the book, I mean, with the story of the book. And then that same social situation in the early days of television, when there was one television in the house, maybe one television in the neighborhood, movies on television were still a social situation. But now, with four or five TVs in one house, it has suddenly gone to be a lot like reading a book, with everybody watching their own movie and being a solitary experience rather than a social experience.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for bringing that up and putting it so cogently, because I think it's a vital thing, and I do talk about it in the book. I think that the communal experience, which I'm old enough to remember. I can remember going to the movies in the late 1940s, and a lot of people forget this, but more people in the United States went to the movies every week in, say, 1946 than at any other time in the history of the movies. And, you know, the population of the country was more than 100 million less than it is today, but they sold 100 million tickets a week. Today we sell maybe 25 million tickets a week. So that it was a huge experience. And effectively, when you went to the movies, the place was packed. And I agree, that sense of being with a mass of strangers, laughing with them together, crying with them together, I think it's a wonderful model for democracy. And there's another thing, of course, you also have to remember, is that in those days, movie theaters were palaces. They were generally bigger than they are today. And the screen was bigger. And I think, I'm one of those people who really prefers the emotional size of the big screen. I don't think any movie on DVD, although it's an ideal way of watching, I don't think any movie in that medium is ever quite as powerful or as beautiful as it is on the big screen, where a face can be the size of a house almost. But I absolutely agree with you, and I think that today we've reached a situation where a kind of loneliness has set in, where, as you say, the same house, there may be four or five TV sets, and every member of the house is watching something different. And there is not that shared experience where people talk about what they see in the same way. And as you may have gathered, I love the notion of people seeing something and then talking about it.
Another thing that makes the and you've already mentioned this, is with the VCR, it is possible to watch, to go back and see a scene over, or to watch the movie over. In fact,
yes.
Many, you know, well, once you buy a movie, well, you probably watch it several times. But that also happens in the movie theaters. I mean, the...
Oh, people go back several times.
Yeah, that didn't used to be, I don't think. But, I mean, that in order to get a really big hit these days in the theater, you have to have a movie that people are willing to go back, I think mostly young people.
Well, of course, in the old days, you could go into a movie at midday, into a movie theater, and they then had continuous performances. And you could sit there for your single price of admission, and you could see the film over and over again. Nowadays, they clear the house out after every screening so that you can't do that.
One of the things about this repetition movies is that I think there is a difference of that. I know I heard somewhere that Pauline Kael never saw a movie more than once.
That's what she said.
In reviewing it.
Yeah.
And if you see them, there's a difference in a movie that you have seen five or six times, and a movie that you've only seen once, because there is I suppose a magic when you don't know what's happening and you're completely enthralled in it the first time. But as time goes on, I've made the comment that that Hitchcock.
Yes.
To me, does not stand up under repeated.
Once you viewing. Know the trick, once you know the suspense. Yeah.
Well, his what I find about him is that his heroines come across as automatons.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't seem to have any volition of their own, except old Marnie and the gal, the Grace Kelly role in the Rear Window. Is the only ones that seem to have any volition of their own.
Yeah. Well, I think you're quite right that Pauline Kael attitude that. The first time you see a movie is always by far the most important time, so don't bother to see it again. And, you know, I think something else about that is that, personally, one of the things I object to these days is that it's very difficult to go into a movie without having gathered a great deal about it in advance.
Mm. Yeah.
I love that feeling of going in and knowing nothing, so that everything comes as a surprise. That's much tougher to achieve these days.
And another point, too, is the wide screen, which has completely, I think, it sort of, I watch movies at home. I don't see them in the theaters. So I just, I'm busy at the time that the theaters are open.
Yeah.
But the wide screen is wonderful for seascapes and cityscapes and battlescapes and gamescapes, but for an intimate, small intimate picture like Random Harvest, for example. I mean, a Random Harvest would be lost on a widescreen.
Well, when you say a widescreen, you mean one where the picture is wider than it is tall.
I mean the format, the widescreen format.
Yeah. I mean, don't forget, Random Harvest originally played as a 35-millimeter film and generally played in theaters that had very big screens.
Well,
and the emotion of that film, and it, you know, it's a very appealing film, depends a great deal on the size of the faces, I think.
And there may be other people waiting, so I do would like to ask you a question.
Yeah, yeah.
Since you wrote about Orson Welles.
Yes.
I have heard that the reason that Hearst was so ticked off about Citizen Kane was the fact that Rosebud was his intimate name for Marion Davies. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard the same story. I've never been able to prove it because, as you would imagine, it's a very difficult thing and somewhat embarrassing to prove it. But yes, the story is that Rosebud was a sexual nickname and endearment that he had for Marion Davies, and I think it's a wonderful story. I would just say that I think that if Welles had found that out by some means, he was absolutely the tease and the cheeky little guy to have done it. I can believe that he would have loved finding that out and would have plugged it into the film straight away. But whether this was really something that was shared by Hearst and Mrs. Davies, that I don't think we're ever going to be able to prove for sure.
Well, thanks for the questions and the observations, to that listener from southeastern Illinois. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Indiana, line one. Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, the connection's not great. I guess the first thing for me is, you know, the aspect ratio is what I'm concerned about. And I grew up as a little boy who had a mother who took him to back of every movie it was made. And I think I started out when I was 4 years old. That would have been in 43. So I've got really ingrained in black and white in the aspect ratio that I saw on the movie screen I had seen. But what I really wanted to ask guest is I'm sort of interested basically in movies from when the talkies start in 28 up to about the early 50s. And I've got about, I've got 1,400 VHSs with movies on them, and I'm now finding my interest turning to the biographies of a lot of the character actors and the actors and actresses who since filled in the background but did it quite well. And I have Ephraim Katz's The Film Encyclopedia, pretty good.
Yeah.
Then I have Holloway's Film Goers Companion, which in some ways is just ridiculous. He says, you know, like Bob Smith, he played in Westerns. You know, it's not really delineated much. And Katz's is, and I have a vague memory once when it was in school, going through the library, just, you know, dilly-dallying around, that there was a huge biography of actors and actresses, and it seemed to me it was in sort of an old leather buckram. It may have been from the 30s, as I remember, that gave biographical sketches of...
You mean it had biographical sketches of a whole lot of actors?
Yeah, and I guess it was sort of supposed to be true, not things that the Universal or whatever made up about somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've been on the web looking for things, and everything I plug in, I don't really get what I'm looking for, and I was hoping you might have some author that I should check out, or maybe
a
title.
I don't know this book you're referring to. I can easily believe there was such a book, but I don't know what it is.
It was in the number of volumes, actually. I don't remember how many, but
you know there is a magazine called Current Biography. Do you know that? You can get it in any library, and it goes back, I think it goes back to the 1950s, maybe, and that has got a lot of show business biographies, and it is very well researched, very carefully researched, and I would recommend that as a source. There are some good biographies, written books on some of these people. A lot of them are not always reliable because so many lies or fake facts, call it that rather, were put out about these people. And you know, you take someone like Joan Crawford, that book, Mummy Dearest, that her daughter did, Christina Crawford, that book has so colored the reputation of Joan Crawford that everyone now regards her as a figure of fun. Well, she was a very considerable actress, and I think she had a difficult life, and there's a great need for a really good book on Joan Crawford. But there are some, you know, there are some very good books available, and Katz's book certainly is worthwhile. My own book, if I may plug it, The Biographical Dictionary, you might look at that. That's got a lot of material on the lives of actors, too.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
I purchased the the Holloway's book on actually on films and things,
yeah.
And mine's from 83, and because I found out that the later ones actually do cut out, you know, they have to make a decision.
Yeah.
So they cut out a lot of the films I'm interested in.
I share your feeling. I mean,
you know,
I love that period you're interested in because I would argue that it's the richest period in the history of American film.
I think that's certainly true. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other telephone calls are invited. Questions, comments? Give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Film scholar David Thompson, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. His biographical dictionary of film has been recently updated. It's now titled The New Biographical Dictionary of Film. Both these books, The Whole Equation and The New Biographical Dictionary of Film, available from the publisher Knopf. We have another listener ready to talk with us already here on The Afternoon Magazine. Let's go and talk with this listener in Effingham on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a couple questions. My favorite actor of years gone by is Robert Ryan. And I would like you to give your feelings about him, kind of an assessment of his career. And secondly, there's several movies of his that I would really like to see, but I never can find them on Turner Classics. And one of them is The House of Bamboo.
Oh, yeah.
And there's another one where he played a role that was very similar to the person Howard Hughes.
Yes.
And
a film called Court.
Yes, and why are these never released?
Well, I could talk for the rest of the program about Robert Ryan. He's one of my all-time favorite actors. I have a little link with him in that his daughter, Lisa Ryan, lives in San Francisco, and we're good friends. I think he was an extraordinary actor. He was best known for playing somewhat villainous, dark characters, but he actually has a lot of heroic roles, too. I think he was one of the least sentimental actors. He had a really tough, manly streak to him, and I like him and admire him very, very much. And
a lot of integrity.
A lot of integrity. He was very much involved with left-wing political causes. He and his wife were well-known in Hollywood as leading liberal figures, and I think that shows in a lot of the films he made. As to why you can't get some of those films, well, I'll tell you. This tomorrow evening here in Berkeley, California, I am introducing a screening of another Robert Ryan film called Men in War, which you may know.
Mm-hmm, I do.
Very, very good film he made.
All the rage.
There is only one print left of that film, and the film is not on DVD. And the fact of the matter is that we have not looked after our films. There are a lot of films that are still hard to see. People assume that because of the existence of VCRs and DVDs and so on and so forth, you can see anything. Well, you can see a great deal, and it's much easier for a film scholar than it used to be. But there are still films which, for legal reasons, contested ownership reasons are very, very difficult to find. And I agree. House of Bamboo, for instance, I can't remember the last time I was able to see that. I probably haven't seen it for 30 years.
I remember when I was a kid out in Iowa seeing it on the marquee at the local RKO Orpheum.
Yeah.
And I just loved his...
He's an extraordinary actor, very intriguing figure.
Yeah.
A film he made towards the end of his career where he plays the sort of... He's the man tracking down the Wild Bunch. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Great performance. Great performance.
I think my two favorites would be Crossfire.
Yeah, yeah.
And the one where he was with Barbara Stanwyck and Paul Douglas.
Clash by Night.
Yeah, that's a
yes,
wonderful one.
Yeah. Excellent actor. I agree with you entirely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, I looked up Robert Ryan in your dictionary of film.
Yeah.
And I recall now seeing The Iceman Cometh in 1973.
Very near the end of his life.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that blew me away. I was in high school. I was like, God.
Yeah.
And that... As I recall, that film was made as part of an American Film Institute series. Or
that's right. It was a series of versions of classic plays that was actually originally done for television, I think, and the American Film Institute was involved with it. And that cast, for instance, in The Iceman Cometh, it includes. As I remember, isn't Frederick March in that? I think he is.
I haven't seen it.
And the young Jeff Bridges is in it, and Lee Marvin is in it.
Yeah, okay.
Wonderful cast.
Yeah. Now, are those films available? I remember that was by, like, subscription. You bought a subscription to the series. Are those films available?
The Iceman Cometh, that particular version, was not available for years. But I believe it became available just about a year ago. I think you can get it on VCR. Sometimes local stores may not hold it, but you know, you can get catalogs now of everything that's available. Mm. And I think that film is available.
Yeah. A listener has called in to tell us that our listener in Effingham, who we just talked to, might try Facets. In Chicago.
Facets is one of those catalogs I was just referring to, and probably the most extensive catalog in the country. Yeah.
The new movies that are out there today, how do you decide what you'll go out to see?
Well, essentially, I still go to see everything that I think is sort of halfway decent. I mean, I try to see just about everything that's got any potential value in it. I see a lot of films. So it's my job to keep up and to see them all. But I spend a lot of time looking at old movies too, and I spend a lot of time watching foreign movies. I very much regret that this country as a whole has rather retreated from subtitled films. In the 60s and 70s, there was a great appetite for them, but we seem to have lost that knack of reading subtitles, which I think is a pity.
Hmm. What's out there today that you'd recommend?
Well, I will give a very, very big plug for a film that probably hasn't come to many theaters yet where you are, because it's still only playing in a relatively small number of theaters in the country. But I think Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby is a sensational film.
Hmm.
I just love it. It's very emotional, very powerful, quite old-fashioned, but nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. It strikes me this year's nominees for Best Picture seem like a pretty good crowd. The Aviator, Million Dollar Baby, Finding Neverland, Sideways, Ray.
Well, I mean, of those five, I'm very fond of Million Dollar Baby and Sideways. And again, Sideways is a picture. It's an independent picture, and it may not be playing everywhere, but I would urge your listeners to track it down. Well worthwhile.
Yeah. And Hotel Rwanda, why don't you think it was in the Best Picture category?
I think it should have been.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, one of the great things about the Oscars is that we can always argue with the choices. And there are a couple of films in the choices for Best Picture this year that I wouldn't have put there. I would have liked to see Hotel Rwanda there. I think Kinsey could have been there too. Okay. Interesting picture.
Yeah. We're out of time. I'm sorry to say.
It flew by.
Yes, it did. Well, I hope you'll come back.
Anytime you want me.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll give you a call down the line in the not-too-distant future.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Film scholar David Thompson has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. It's published by Knopf. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Indeed they are, Celeste, and it was a very tough day if you're a holder of corn and soybeans in the bin, as well as a tough day for wheat producers. Wheat contract lows set across the board in the soybeans, contract lows set in most deferred months. The corn market followed down two and a quarter to down three on the day across the board. We'll see what the damage was done from a technical viewpoint. Talk about that at 2:06 Central Time with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Bloomington. Let's look at the particulars. March wheat, a high on the day of 294, a low of 288.5, settling at 289.5, down 5.75. May, a high of 302, a low of 296.5, settling 297.5, down 5.75. July, a high of 307.5, a low of 303.5, settling 304, down 5.5. September, a high of 314, a low of 309.5, settling on the low, down 5.5. December wheat, a high of 522.5, a low of 322.5, a low of 318, settling 318.5, down 5. March corn, a high of 197.75, a low of 195.25, settling 195.75, down 3. May, a high of 205.25, a low of 203, settling 203.25, down 3. July, a high of 212.5, settling 210.5, settling 210.75, down 3. September, a high of 219.25, a low of 218, settling 218.5, down 2.25. December, a high of 229.25, a low of 227.5, settling 228, down 2.25. March, a high of 236, a low of 235.25, settling 235.5, down 2.25. March oats, a high of 169.25, a low of 166.5, settling 168.5, down a half. May, a high of 158.75, a low of 157, settling 158.25, up a quarter on the day. And then that damage in the soybean pit. March, a high of 519, a low of 515.5, settling 515.75, just off the low on the day, down 7.25. May, a high of 517.5, a low of 513.5, settling 514, down 7.25. July, a high of 521, a low of 518, settling 518.5, down 7.25. August, a high of 523.5, a low of 521.5, settling 521.75, down 6.75. September, a high of 526.5, a low of 522, settling 522.25, down 7.25. November, a high of 534, a low of 531, settling 531.25, down 6.75. And then January, a high of 538, a low of 537, settling 537.5, down 6.5 on the day. March soybean meal, a high of 157, a low of 154.80, settling 154.90, down 250. May, a high of 155.80, a low of 154.30, settling 154.50, down 230. March oil, a high of 1947, a low of 1937, settling 1943, down 9. May, a high of 1960, a low of 1951, settling 1958. That was down 5 on the day. Remember, we have a WILO AM 580 Agricultural Outlook panel this evening. Learn more about what happened today or anything else that's on your mind. Bring your questions to the Clinton Library this evening at 6:30. We'll have several of our analysts there. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste, what's going on there?
Looks like a largely lower day today for livestock prices, Dave.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
January feeders, the high today 104.17.5, the low 104.10, the settlement 104.17.5, that down 12.5. March, $100.30, the high, $99.50, the low. The settlement, $99.90, that up 2.5. April, $99.70, the high, $98.80, the low, $99.65, the settlement, that up 12.5. February live cattle, $89.35, the high, $88.45, the low. The settlement, $89.25, that up 12.5. April, $87.80, the high, $86.90, the low. The settlement, $87.65, that up 32.5. February lean hog, $74.30, the high, $73.65, the low, $74.20, the settlement, that down 37.5. April, $75.45, the high, $74.60, the low, the settlement, $75.32.5, that down 17.5. May, $76.10, the high, $75.40, the low, $75.92.5, the settlement, that down 17.5. June, $78 even, the high, the low, $77.20, the settlement, $77.92.5, that down 20. And February bellies, $94.30, the high, $93.45, the low, $94.07.5, the settlement, that down 45. The Dow is down 59 points, the NASDAQ off 7, the S&P 500 down 3 points.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Bill Gee from Redmond, Washington writes, Dear Dr. Science, when in the produce